Hello and welcome back. This is Victoria Duda from Zenith Lifestyle, and we are bringing you another episode of the Metaphysical Podcast, which relates to what we have been spoken about in the last two episodes when we discussed near-death experiences, as a result of which we came to the conclusion something happens after we die. It is not over. We have experiences in the state where the mind still functions, albeit the brain is dead. The question, of course, now that arises is what happens after? So often near-death experiencers reported that they had a panoramic life review where their guides were showing them the events of their lives, often in a synchronistic way, often in a way that everything seemed to happen at the same time, beyond or above time and space. And they were shown how they lived, and they were shown the effects of every little detail of their lives that it had on other people. So that is a little bit similar to the judgment that we hear of in ancient religious teachings, that there is a weighing of the heart, like the ancient Egyptians said, what was good about your life, what was not so good about your life. But what the near-death experiencers say to us, that it's not so much a judgment, there is no value judgment in it, but more an kind of assessment in a friendly and in a very cooperative way to show you the way, to show the way to source evolution. So obviously, if that's the case, then this also implies that there must be a way to evolve too. It can't be over with just one assessment. It's a little bit like if you go to school and you get one test, you get one result, the school is not over. If you get a feedback, then you're expected to do it again, to try it again, and to do it better. And therefore, one of the most ancient metaphysical concepts, and this is the concept that we are talking about today, is the concept of reincarnation. That we don't just live once, but we live over and over again, and that our lives are actually like daytime that follows by nighttime, that follows by death. But also that nighttime, also that death, is followed by another morning, by another daytime. So every death is followed by a rebirth. The idea itself is very, very ancient. Ancient Egyptians had a quite sophisticated understanding of reincarnation, and so did the ancient Greeks, actually. They called it the sorrowful, weary wheel. And Plato himself said that, for example, if someone had knowledge that they acquired very easily, think of a child who is a prodigy in a certain area, then that is because the enduring self, that's how Plato called the self that is transcending lifetimes, the enduring self that has learned the same thing in an easier life and therefore in an earlier life, and therefore it flows back easily. Buddha, who's prototypical for teaching reincarnation, it said that he was teaching that doctrine because he himself remembered 550 previous lives. So according to tradition, Buddha started his process of enlightenment about 25,000 years before he was reborn as the historic Buddha. And his first life in which he was starting on the path of enlightenment was when he was in a hell realm. He was a hell being. But he first generated compassion towards the fellow sufferers that he encountered in that hell realm. So there was the seed of enlightenment planted in that lifetime, because the seed of enlightenment is genuine compassion and the desire to become of service to others. But from that moment on, when that desire first was born in Buddha's soul, it took another 25,000 years to actually become enlightened. So this also shows us that metaphysically it's not meant to be quick, and metaphysically it's not meant to be in an instant or one life. Reincarnation was very much a doctrine that goes back in time, even into early Christian thought. There is a lot of debate going on about whether reincarnation was or wasn't a part of early Christian doctrine. But one of the interesting things is that an early Christian theologist, Origen, wrote completely clearly about reincarnation. Let me give you a quote. He said that every soul comes into this world strengthened by the victories or weakened by the defeats of its previous life. Previous life, it's quite clear. Its place in this world as a vessel appointed to honor or dishonor is determined by its previous merits or demerits. So what Origen, an early Christian theologist, is actually giving us in this quote is the doctrine of karma. That what you sow, that you reap. And it's beyond the shadow of a doubt that Christianity has that thought as well. It's in the Bible. But the question is only, what kind of time frame does it encompass? Origen himself says there are previous lives. But everything that I mentioned so far is actually a religious teaching. And it is in the spirit of this podcast that we don't want to find just purely religious or philosophical doctrines, but we want to find things, truth that are related to experiences. And this is where the issue of reincarnation becomes really interesting. This is where the issue of reincarnation becomes really interesting to me, for example, as a therapist. Because when you work in therapy, you can have concrete results of reincarnation. So what I mean is that in the 1950s, it was psychologists like, for example, Stanislav Grof, who first experimented with the birth memories of people. And these early therapists were thinking, what kind of effect can it have on a person, the way they were birthed into this life? That was the time when people started to realize that, for example, a traumatic birth that maybe had complications, it was particularly painful, can have a traumatic result in later life. So psychologists were trying to find a way, sometimes under hypnosis, to bring people back into their birth memories in order to bring up any kind of trauma and heal it. Now, what was interesting with these early experiments that a lot of people who were brought back into their birth memories, and that was quite widespread. I mean, there was, for example, Helen Wambach, one of the psychologists who did this kind of experiment. Helen Wambach regressed 750 people with the help of hypnosis into their birth experience. And it was an interesting experience and interesting experiment that she put up, because from all her subjects, they reported that they came into this world as actually mature consciousnesses. I think this is an extremely important point. It was not like a newborn baby that had no brain and that had to start to develop consciousness. No, it was a complete, full-blown adult consciousness that suddenly was sucked into a baby's body. And in most cases, it was actually kind of shock, limiting from being in the, what a lot of people call the light, or into in the spirit realm. And then they had to be suddenly in this little baby body. And they were also aware that soon they are going to lose the memory of previous existences. And they have to start to develop a brain. But in that moment of birth, they were all in the, you know, it's still in the spirit realm, and they were having a full-blown consciousness. And they were also aware of the feelings and thoughts of people around in the delivery room, which is interesting because they were also aware of their mother's thoughts and feelings that were not always as positive as you would expect. A lot of mothers were scared, had kind of fear, were suffering, were afraid of the responsibility and that kind of things. So these were the early experiments on the birth experience. And it's quite enlightening, actually, to think that birth was reported by most people as traumatic. And if you remember from the last couple of podcasts, that death was reported by most of the people who experienced it as extremely euphoric. Quite the opposite way around, as we think. You know, we tend to celebrate birth and cry over death. And it seems that they're quite the opposite, that death is a release into the spirit realm where we are much more free. And birth is a kind of traumatic experience because it reduces our consciousness into a baby's brain. But what I wanted to say, and why I was talking about Helen Wombach's experiences, is that some of these experiments didn't stop at birth. Psychologists were bringing people back into their birth experience for therapeutic reasons. And then completely unexpectedly, they just started to talk about a story that happened before they were born. So these were spontaneous regressions into past lives that the early psychologists didn't know how to treat. But there's been some research ever since, and it seems that remembering past lives is almost always extremely therapeutic and valuable. Despite the fact that people are interpreting these kind of experiences differently. So some people say, okay, what I've experienced in a past life regression is actually my historic past life, and they believe in reincarnation. But some people don't. I remember when I was qualifying as a hypnotherapist and we learned past life regressions as a kind of therapeutic technique. And we were instructed to say, yeah, you don't have to believe in reincarnation in order to use these techniques. Because if you don't believe, and you're still doing a so-called regression, then what happens is you will get a psychological metaphor. You will get a story that is illustrating exactly the issues that a person needs to deal with at any given time. But sometimes it is difficult for a person to deal with an issue directly, because then that's like facing a mirror one-to-one, seeing all the faults and troubles that one has to deal with. But if you do it in a more metaphorical way, then it's much easier to face. So, all in all, it's interesting to say that we have material now. These days we have material that shows that any given human beings have memories, if we dig really deep, that is coming from times that are beyond our birth, that is before our birth. Ancient Tibetans, for example, always knew that. They're talking about a bardo state. They're talking about a state that is between death and rebirth. And some modern schools, like the International Academy of Consciousness that we met in previous podcasts, they also acknowledge the fact that life goes in a kind of wavy line, like a sinus curve, that you have a period that you spend in a lifetime, in a physical dimension. And then when you die, then you will have a time that you spend in the spirit realm, in the non-physical dimension. And then when you're reborn, then you get back into life again, into the physical reality. But both of these times are valuable. And in both of these times, there's a learning happening. So, for example, we learn while we are alive. But according to this theory, we also learn after we died. For example, the IAC acknowledges that there are intermissive courses in between lives. And some of the consciousnesses that are more evolved, they visit these courses. Yeah, you can think of it as a non-physical school, as a non-physical academy, where you are introduced to understanding more of the evolutionary mechanisms that govern life, so that when you're reborn, then you are better equipped to live an authentic life that is helping your own and other people's evolution. The crucial question now that, of course, arises is if life and death and the circles of life and death are learning experiences, what is it that we learn? And what are the mechanisms of learning? And as you can imagine, when people do past life therapies, past life regressions, a lot of traumatic experiences come up. And these themselves constitute learning experiences. That, for example, if someone has gone through a traumatic experience, then that experience tend to repeat itself for as long as something is gained out of it, something is learned out of it. This is actually one of the psychological proofs of the validity of past life experiences, because those past life experiences that come up in theory and also in therapy, they behave in the same way as memories about our present life. So psychologically speaking, if you have memories, for example, about our childhood, these memories are very often distorted psychologically. If it's, for example, very traumatic, we tend to repress it. We tend to do something with it that it makes it easier for us to deal with those memories. And they're called psychological self-protection mechanisms. And it is, work of the psychologists, work of the psychotherapists, that you bring these mechanisms into awareness. And then you actually confront that memory that, for example, you have been repressing. If that occurs, then there is a shift in awareness, and that shift in awareness leads to a change in life. It's a healing experience. That's how I noticed that the therapy worked, that there is some change in the person's life that is good. And past life memories that come up in theory behave exactly the same way psychologically. They are sometimes distorted, they are repressed. People are using all sorts of mechanisms to protect themselves from something too traumatic. But if it's successful in theory, in therapy, that you bring back these experiences into consciousness, then that will produce a change in the person's life. And this is where the value of the whole therapy is. So people confront their traumatic experiences of the past. And one type of trauma that comes up very often is that a person has experienced a situation in which they were victims of something. I mean, if you just look back into human history, you can guess that there was a lot of horrible stuff going on. Yeah, there were a lot of wars, there was a lot of torture, there was things like slavery, and people suffered through that. So, of course, if you find yourself bringing into your memory a past experience that was traumatic in that way, then you will have to find a way to deal with it. In the same way as you deal with a traumatic experience that you, for example, had in your childhood. But even more interesting than that, and I think people don't think about that when they embark on that kind of journey, that they might not have just been victims. They might have been the persecutors. And that is sometimes even harder to deal with. Psychologically speaking, that means that they are facing what Jung called the shadow. So imagine that someone goes into a past life regression and they are seeing themselves as being burned as a witch on the stake. Okay, that's hard to deal with. But imagine that you see yourself as being someone who is condemning a person to be burned on the stake, and it's your responsibility. That is probably even harder to deal with. Because if you do past life regression, you're going to have your 21st century consciousness that has to deal with the fact that you've been a torturer, you've been a murderer, you've been a war criminal or something like that in your past lives. I don't want to go into great details, but when I started to do my own past life regressions, I had to deal with a lot of material in that way. And it does make you feel you're evil. So how do you deal with that? That is the highest level of learning how to forgive yourself. How to forgive people that have wronged you, but then also how to forgive yourself when you've been wronging people. I just want to give you a couple of examples of there are actually techniques of how to achieve that, how to come over these traumatic experiences. For example, imagine that you are the victim. There was actually a case that's documented in literature that a woman was burned as a witch. And she had to deal with that experience in a regression. And the way she could overcome the trauma was that she was guided to go back into the experience and then actually put herself into the minds of the opponents, into the minds of those people that wronged her. So she was putting herself into the minds of the priests that burned her as a witch. And when she did that, it came out that those priests were severely scared of her. They saw her as a threat to the healthy life of the community. And as soon as she could understand that from a very personal level, she could forgive them because she understood that their intentions were actually good, even though their actions were evil. And it is the same way how someone can heal their own sins, if you want to put it like that. So when someone is, you know, in the past has done something wrong, one of the ways to heal that is to ask the person, yeah, but what was your positive intent? There was one person, also a case documented in literature, who was a member of the Inquisition. And it turned out that at that time, it seemed that the Inquisition is the only answer to the corruption that was going on in the church. So they had a positive intention. They wanted to reform and to heal the church. Of course, it went with wrong methods. But it is one way that can help to forgive oneself and then turn the entire thing into a learning experience. It seems that humanity throughout history has learned through suffering. But we have probably come to a time in history when we can change that and when we can also learn through love. It is very interesting thing from the research that Helen Wambach has done. You might recall her name. I mentioned her earlier. She was a psychologist who was helping people to go back into their birth memories. And one of the questions that she asked those people, those 750 people she hypnotized into their birth experiences, was that, why did you choose to be born at the end of the 20th century? Now, we are all living at the end of the 20th century, at the beginning of the 21st century. What made you choose that particular historic time? And a lot of people answered exactly the same. So it seems to be there is something special about our time that people, or the soul consciousness, since before birth were acknowledging, namely that we live in exceptional times. Waldo Vieira, who's the founder of International Academy of Consciousness, he says the same thing. We are living at very special times. If you're born today, and if you're living in the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century, you have to know that the amount of evolution that is going on, the speed of evolution is much faster, much greater than it's been in previous times. What people say to Helen Wambach was that we live in a very important time of change, that there are monumental changes. Some people use the word monumental. And they also use words like great awakening. So they say that if you look back at history, then there was a religious view of things that go way to a scientific view of things. But we now, at this age, live where we can transcend both, and we live in a day and age of spiritual awakening. One of Helen Wambach's subjects also said there is an increasing awareness of the spiritual element in Western cultures. Another therapist who was looking into people's memories from before the birth said something very similar. It's Barbara Findeisen who said that it seems that in this particular time in history, entrance into an altered state is much easier and faster than it was formerly. It is as though the veils separating the states have become very thin, meaning that there is something in our present moment where we don't have to suffer too much. We seem to have the intelligence and the abilities to learn through love, in other words, to see the fact that we both live in a physical but also in a spiritual reality, and that we can awaken to the truth that lies in both. And we can learn by speeding up our evolution and not having to experience trauma and trauma over and over again until we actually get the message. We can be conscious enough to help ourselves to get the message. So you might ask the question, okay, this sounds all very intriguing, but how do we do that? How can I, maybe who's listening to this podcast, how can I actually find out about my own past lives? And I would answer to the question that it is a complex thing. Of course, you can try a technique, you can try hypnosis or self-hypnosis, but I think the best method is actually to go into a process, to build it into your consciousness that you are ready now and you're willing to receive the information that will help you to put the puzzle of the past together. So I don't believe in a single regression session, for example, that it will do the job. I believe much more in putting the intention out in the universe to be able and to be ready to receive the information. And even expose yourself to situations that might help you trigger the memories. For example, if you feel that you're in some ways more drawn to a certain historic period or even to a certain historic personality, and you can expose yourself to information by watching movies or reading books. Wagner Allegretti, who wrote a very interesting book about retrocognitions, that's the word he's using for, you know, gaining information about past lives, he's even saying you can set up a what he calls a retrocognitarium, a room in your house that has no indications of the 21st century, that doesn't have, for example, electric equipment or anything else that would tell your mind when you look at it that, okay, we are actually in the 21st century. You look at a CD player, it's 21st century. You look at a computer, it's 21st century. But if you can build a room that is neutral, or if you have, you find yourself drawn to a certain period of history and even maybe decorated in that period, then that might help your brain to start tuning in. I personally found that this is a tuning in process. At the beginning, it's a little bit of trial and error. You're playing with it like a child plays with something new. But when the memory is genuine, at least in a psychological sense, then you will know it because remembering will produce changes. So finding about past lives is not just an intellectual thing, I believe. It's also connecting to one's own feelings. So even if we can't remember facts of past lives, but from our present life and how we feel at the moment, we can find out a lot about where we are in our existential cycle. What I mean is that people who are content with what they are doing in their lives, they're much more likely to actually live that existential agenda, the mission that they were born to fulfill. And people who are deeply unsatisfied, even though they might be outwardly successful, they might be rich, they might be prestigious, but if they feel a kind of emptiness within, then that is quite a sign for the fact that they might have missed the exact lesson why they were reborn to learn, and they might have missed that mission that they were here to complete. Because if we think of terms of evolution, then we are all here to fulfill a certain mission that is particularly important in our present stage of evolution. If we are at the beginning of that evolution, then we might just have little tasks, like learning a certain interpersonal behavior, maybe have a family in order to learn something about interpersonal relationships. But if we are maybe more evolved, then we might be here for a bigger mission, maybe to teach others and to help others to awaken as well. How we feel about our present state in which we are is a very, very strong indicator to how much we are fulfilling that life mission. actually, it's interesting to note that most people who live, they do feel a sense of incompleteness. And they do feel a sense of maybe melancholy or depression. And that often is an indicator for the fact that they are not on the track, which is not so hard these days because today we live in a society that does a lot to bring us off track. But as soon as we feel something that connects us with our authentic purpose, then that is a path to follow. And the more we follow our path, the more clear it will become. Another danger that can go wrong while we are on an evolutionary path is that we all tend to repeat our own patterns. So one standard example is actually the prodigy child that I mentioned at the beginning. You know, so someone is, for example, being born with an extreme talent for music, say. And it's very easy for that person to become a musician. But if he has been a musician for, I don't know how many past years, then all he's doing is he's repeating himself. Past years, past lives, past dozens of lives, perhaps. We all have to learn something new, and we all have to do something new with our talents. So perhaps with the in the example of the musician who is born with obvious talents for music and who finds learning music very easy, it's not going to be a great evolutionary step to become just a great concert pianist. Because that might be just a repetition of talents that he already possesses. But maybe the next step will be to learn to use that musical talent to awaken people to a spiritual truth. I think Mozart might be a very good example for that. I'm not sure that this is just a guess, but he was born as a miracle child in music, so obviously he has brought that with him from previous existences. But when he composed things like the Zauberflöte, the magic flute, then he was using that music to bring certain truth into general public awareness that were quite secret at that time, because Mozart was a Freemason, and he has learned a lot of metaphysical truth by being affiliated with the Freemasons. But the Freemasons were working extremely in secret at the time. It was completely forbidden to talk about their teachings in public. So if you look at the story of the Zauberflöte, he's actually bringing metaphysical, esoteric truths into the story to make it available for a general public. So he was using his musical talents to spread spiritual truth. Sometimes, even in near-death literature, we can find cases where people were not fulfilling their mission and they got a kind of moratorium. They went through the near-death experience and they were told to come back. They were actually told that there is an unfinished business here. And they got a second chance to come back. And those people, they are characterized by a complete determination. That they feel that every moment in their lives are completely important and they can't waste any time anymore. And I think that is when we are all in a state that is right for a revolution, where we feel that we don't have any time anymore to waste. That doesn't mean that we have to panic, because at the same time, this kind of knowledge also gives us the feeling that we have a lot of time to evolve, because it takes a lot of time. But we don't have any time anymore to waste. We can take all our time that it takes to evolve, but we can't have wasted time. One more thing I would like to mention before I close up is that it seems from near-death experiences and from a lot of the spiritual literature, from spiritual teachings, that the way we perceive time and space is not necessarily how it works in the non-physical reality. So in certain ways, our time perception is an illusion. And this doesn't just show itself into the direction of the past, but it shows itself also into the direction of the future. There's a couple of psychologists and therapists who are looking into the future. And Anna Hirsch is one of them. And he has a very remarkable thought that I want to share with you, and namely, that if this is all true, that we are souls, we are consciousnesses in evolution, and there is a part of us that lives outside of time and space, then there is not just a part of us that comes from the past, so we don't just have a past, and we don't just have a present, but we will also have a future self. And if that future self reaches a level of evolution where it can travel between the physical and the non-physical reality, then that consciousness is also capable of visiting us in the past. And this sounds very science fiction kind of thinking, but even when I was, for example, experiencing my own past lives and I was doing past life regressions to explore my own past, which has changed my life very dramatically, but I went back into the past to a certain extent. I reached a certain level of evolution when I started to become curious about who was I maybe 500 years ago. And I revisited that past. So you could assume from that that there will be also a future self that is visiting the present. But from a peasant's point of view, that means that you can get in touch with your future self. And that is a tremendously exciting idea if you're thinking about it, that you might have spiritual guides, but one of your spiritual guides might be your own future self. So if you find this talk that I've given today interesting enough to, you know, maybe have a little bit of curiosity of exploring yourself, who you were in the past, and please don't just think about who you were in the past, but also who are you becoming in the future. And if you can start to see yourself in the future, then you can also start to see the pattern that you need to go through to evolve into that future self of you. And with that thought for today, I would like to close. And I would like to wish you a very happy full moon, and with a lot of memories from not just the past, not just about where we are coming from, but ultimately also where we are going. Thank you very much.